wonderful things that somebody like Clay Myers did. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindbergh. Ms. Lindbergh, we really appreciate your joining us today, and we'd certainly ask that your family join us on the Senate floor when we hear the memorial, if you wish to be here. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Any other comments for the record?
Well, maybe I should just say that I knew him from the ecumenical end of things. During my years in the clergy, we had lots of points of intersection, many good conversations. And then once I left being a good guy and became one of the dirty, rotten politicians, I still kept in touch with him. That was great.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're in work session. The chair would move SCR 9 to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. I'm going to ask Senator Carter to carry this resolution on the Senate floor, and we'll be happy to schedule with the family in terms of the day we hear it. So, thank you both very much. Thanks for joining us. Chair would open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2189. Ms. Harris, what do we have?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2189A specifies that final wages earned by an employee but paid to the employee's spouse or dependent child on death are considered wages for purposes of calculating benefits under the PERS system.
And we are working off the...
We have dash 2 and dash 3 amendments up for consideration today, and we have some witnesses here who can testify as to the substance of both of those amendments.
Okay. I'm going to ask Ms. Darby and Mr. Green to come forward, and on deck I've got Sharon McKeehan and Bob Dumig. You want to come up here? Okay.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association and also as a member of the PERS Coalition, the essentially labor members who represent PERS members, PERS public employees. House Bill 2189, we have amendments that keep the original content out as outlined by the committee administrator, but then also amend with some employer and employee agreed upon fixes to the relationship between PERS and the new retirement system, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Program. The first five sections of the bill have to do with the original portion of House Bill 2189, and then I believe Mr. Dumig will present on sections 4 and 5.
Okay.
The sections 6 forward are the portions of the bill that have to do with the employer and employee agreed upon changes.
Okay.
Sections, do you want me to go through it section by section?
I do. We apparently do not have copies of the amendments yet. They're coming. So why don't you go ahead and...
Would you like Mr. Dumig?
That's probably best.
Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dumig. I'm with Oregon Health and Science University. The changes or the portions that affect OHSU is back in 2000 when the legislation was, House Bill 2020 was originally passed. The definition of school employee was defined as teaching in or other school activities that did not include OHSU. They used the university system as a definition of which OHSU is no longer a part of. So we have asked, and it was able to be amended on the House side to include OHSU back into that definition to include about 60 of our employees, most of them in the rural area and many of them with the School of Nursing. One thing that got left out in that, which are the dash A2s, was to take that effective date back to August 29, 2003, when the previous legislation went into effect. So the dash A2s just take that change that was made on the House side. It makes it effective back on August 29th, 2003.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Dumig?
Beginning with Section 6, it addresses the issue of break in service from PERS Tier 1 and Tier 2, where folks move to the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. Section 6 specifically addresses issues for folks with seasonal employment or who have suffered injuries on the job, and allows them to come back to the PERS system. Section 8 has to do with members that were inactive on August 29th, 2003, the date of implementation of the new retirement system. These PERS members who may have taken a break from service did not receive any notice of that they may be bumped into a new plan on return to public employment. What this section specifies is that if they return to the same employer and they are a vested members of PERS and they return by August 2005, then they can return to Tier 1 and Tier 2. So we put a window on it, but also giving them a little bit of time to correct if they so choose. Sections 9 and 10 have to do with members that may receive a break in service. It allows years to be counted from either program to meet eligibility criteria. So, for example, if you need to receive a disability, if you qualify for disability, it allows you to use your 5 years under PERS and then an additional 5 years under OPSERP to meet the requirement for 10 years of service prior to receiving a disability benefit. Sections 13 has to do with if a member has a break in service, it allows their earliest retirement age to be that for that used under Chapter 238, which is the PERS chapter. Sections 14 and 15 have to do with death benefits, and I believe it's called, I'm looking at PERS just to make sure I've got this piece right. It's a piece we worked pretty hard with them on. It has to do with the pop-up benefit for death benefits. Is that correct? It's the match of the individual account program in the OPSERP plan, because PERS Tier 1 and Tier 2 members are now also members of OPSERP. Section 16 is has to do with determination of salary under the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. It allows for overtime in by groups of people. It makes sure that folks that belong to a certain category of employees, they get their overtime based on an average of all employees in that group. And what this says is that for the state of Oregon, it allows for geographic distinctions.
Geographic distinctions?
Well, for example, with corrections employees in eastern Oregon, they may have more overtime requirements than folks that are in Salem. And it allows the state of Oregon to differentiate between geographic areas for purposes of determining overtime. Because the state of Oregon, other employers won't really be impacted by this because they tend to be more regionalized. For example, a school district is a single employer, and they would be able to look at their overtime for a class of employees. The state of Oregon is so large that there may be distinctions based on geographic areas where folks live and are employed. Section 19 through 21 has to do with community colleges, and you may remember at the last hearing we had on this issue that one of the issues brought forward was how to address part-time community college faculty who are hired based on an FTE basis. And what this section does is we did our best to make it as similar to what's going on with PERS as possible, and it creates a formula for turning FTE, full-time equivalent positions, into hours of service. We worked very hard with the Oregon Community Colleges Association and the American Federation of Teachers to reach this language, and we're just very pleased that we were able to include it in this omnibus bill.
I know you don't speak for the community colleges, but does this resolve the issues regarding PERS that the community colleges have? I, at least in terms of the part-time, non-part-time. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
That's the beauty of this bill, is I think you have employers and employees in agreement on the content of the bill, and we're just about, I think I'm done. So unless Jim Green of the Oregon School Boards Association has other comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, also appearing before you representing public employers, which includes the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and Special Districts Association of Oregon, over 838 public employers. We work very closely with the PERS Coalition to draft this, and it was no small issue to come together on issues like this. But with the massive changes the 2003 legislature made, there were some things that what we would call unintended circumstances or instances that got shoved into that law that we needed to correct. One, which we all knew we needed to fix, was break in service for folks who suffered an on-the-job injury. And knowing the area I work in, schools, you had a bus driver who out of their no fault of their own got in an accident and couldn't work, but couldn't return to work within 6 months. They were taken from Tier 1 or Tier 2 status and put into the new plan that was created by House Bill 2020 of the 03 session. In fairness to those folks, it was no fault of their own. They need to be maintaining that Tier 1 and Tier 2 status, as well as the other issue of break in service for someone who got caught outside of the country, literally are the results we're seeing. When the governor signed in House Bill 2020 that created the break in service, we wanted to provide a window for those folks to come back so that just when they were caught outside of that window for those folks to be put back in. One piece that we could not come to agreement on, and I wanted to mention for the committee because we are going to look at it over the interim, probably come back to the 07 session and look at, is the issue of part-time employees who are in the new tier, Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, because the way the plan works under that, you have to work so many hours in a year to qualify for a year. One of the issues that's in that is you have to be at 30 years into the program in order to retire. Well, if you're part-time under OPSERPS, the way it's being interpreted, the way it's being read, would be that you'd have to work 60 years in order to do that. And we're looking at that, but there will not be anyone this biennium that will be caught by that. It's a future issue, but we just got the costing back from the PERS actuary on that. And as you can well imagine, PERS has a new actuary that's working through the plan. We just got that this morning, and we couldn't agree on the actual cost associated with that, but I do want to guaranteed to the PERS Coalition on behalf of employers, we do want to revisit that issue. But this A3 is a compilation of agreements between public employers and public employee coalition, and we do support it. We will work on the House side to ensure that there's a concurrence vote. Only the agreement we struck is that only if PERS comes up with technical issues would we not concur on the House side. If there's something that PERS sees technically that won't work, we would work with them in order to get that on the House side. And as far as the A2s are concerned, that's an issue that OHSU has been working on during the interim. We support the A2s as well.
Okay. So just to clarify for the record, Ms. Darby, Mr. Green, you were focused on the dash A3s. Mr. Dumig, you had the dash A2s. Okay. All right. Any questions for the panel? All right. Thank you very much. I have Ms. McKeon. Mr. Laney, do you wish to testify on it? You don't have to.
No.
Okay. All right. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sharon McKeon, representing the Department of Administrative Services. House Bill 2189 is intended to eliminate conflict between two present state laws. The ORS 652190 covers final salary and wage payments made to a deceased employee, and it indicates that all monies due and payable to that employee are passed to the surviving spouse or surviving children. The PERS statute 238005 did not clearly include wages paid to a deceased employee as PERS subject wages. And so the proposed change to 238005 and 238A005 stating that wages of a deceased member paid to a surviving spouse or dependent children under ORS 652190 would then make that subject wages or salaries. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Delaney, just want to come, just for the record, just to clarify that you're all right with both the dash A2 and the dash A3 amendments.
Madam Chair, certainly we're fine with dash A2. We've seen those dash A3. We're going to have to step back and look at it for technical issues.
All right. Since the amendments are still literally hot, just came off the printing press for us, we will not move forward on these amendments today. We anticipate it is Thursday. As soon as we can get this notice for work session, we will do that. So, all right. Thank you. Close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2189. Open work session on Senate Bill 1028. Brendan, come on forward. Is your last name McCarthy? Did I just make that up? It just sounded like too much like a movie star.
He looks like one.
My last name's whatever you need it to be.
Could you walk through the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 1028, please?
For the record, Brendan McCarthy, Deputy Legislative Counsel. The dash 5s are remarkably similar to the dash 1s, so I will only speak to the changes that are incorporated in the dash 5s, as I've already spoken to the dash 1s at the previous hearing. On page 1, line 13, we've added natural before waterway. That was intended to ensure that things like irrigation ditches, irrigation canals, and other unnatural or artificial water bodies would not be included as Class 2 waterways. With that change, I believe that because of the reference to natural waterways under Class 1 and Class 2, that this bill only applies to natural water bodies. On page 2 in section 2, line 27 and 28, we've made a change. The State Land Board no longer will contract with just any public body, but instead an entity of the Executive Department to ensure that they're not going to be contracting with local watershed councils or other smaller governmental entities around the state to do river-by-river plans. In section 3, page 3, subsection 5, we've made some changes to the advisory committee language and to emphasize that the committee itself will hear issues related to conflicts between landowners and recreational users and serve as sort of the first stop for conflict information gathering, but not necessarily resolution, and then forward any recommendations for resolution of conflict on to the State Land Board. We've made a change on page 4. Section 4, subsection 2 is new, and it emphasizes that person making recreational use of a waterway has to exercise reasonable and prudent care and not unreasonably interfere with the rights of riparian landowners. Designed to deal with the situation of someone on the river just running their jet boat back and forth one particular landowner's property to annoy them. Hopefully, if we put in a reasonableness factor, that would condition their use to hopefully prevent that type of action. Skipping down quite a ways, I think, page 7, section 7, we've done the same to the landowners. Landowners now must also exercise their rights of a landowner so as to not unreasonably interfere with the persons making recreational uses of Class 1 waterways. Hopefully that will put a restrict fencing across waterways or other unreasonable actions by landowners.
Madam Chair, what section did you say?
It's 7, sub 2, right?
Page
7?
Yeah. Madam Chair, that's correct. Page 7, section 7, subsection 2.
Questions on that one? Did you have any further questions on that?
No,
on
that one.
Okay.
We have on page 9, subsection 5 of section 9, modified the way the money flows for law enforcement services to the State Marine Board, and how the State Marine Board will obtain monies to do to with local law enforcement, contract for law enforcement on Class 1 waterways. That was suggested by the, to some extent, by the Marine Board, and we think, or I think it's a good change to try and limit the back and forth nature of and who does the law enforcement. It will, who contracts for the law enforcement, it will be the Marine Board. And then I think the rest of the changes are at the tail end of the bill. Section 18 and 19. Section 18, we've added, previously it only said nothing in sections 4, 5, or 6. Now it says nothing in sections 1 to 11 and amendments to various ORS sections to clarify that nothing in virtually the entire bill affects rights of landowners to engage in farming practices and the things you see in that section. The other thing is we've broadened subsection 4 of that section to specifically say the canals and ditches, nothing affects recreational use of surface water of lakes, canals, and ditches or other confined water bodies.
Mr. McCarthy, my recollection is the attempt on this provision is to make sure that lakes like Lake Oswego are not included. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that was the intent of the requester.
Okay.
However, I think it's to some extent a belts and suspenders approach. As I said, with the first change on the first page, adding natural to waterway, I think probably takes care of it. But if people feel this is necessary, I don't have any objection to it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I just, what about lakes that are not artificial? How does this impact?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, we've attempted to ensure that there are several things going on. Number one, our definition of Class 1 waterway says that they have to be free-flowing, and so that should probably eliminate natural lakes because they wouldn't generally be considered free-flowing. But alternatively, the recreational use of lakes is already settled, and we do not intend to change that by this bill.
And
we, I mean,
just to clarify, the whole navigability issue doesn't have to do with lakes. It has to do with rivers, streams.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that the issue of navigability as it relates to lakes is settled, or is not controversial and needing any sort of codification or legislative direction to understand what the rights are to use a lake.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Shields, did you have some questions?
The one question that I had from a conversation the other day had to do with the public's access issue. And I'm sorry, I stepped out for a minute, and maybe you addressed that while I was out. Does this restrict the public in terms of access more than previously, do you think?
Might be a better question for Ms. Deckard, but if you want to answer that, that's fine, Mr. McCarthy.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, most of this bill does not deal directly with the question of access. The only thing that comes to mind as far as access is concerned in this bill is the use of upland for emergency use or to make, I believe it's, right, emergency use, which would be medical attention or if your boat breaks and you need to leave the waterway. But we have not, there is nothing in the bill that would directly relate to access points.
As I was looking through stuff, I couldn't find the email that referred to that, but maybe somebody else has.
I don't know. Right. Mr. Decker, do you want to add anything?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Amy Decker, the Oregon State Treasury. Madam Chair, Senator Shields,
I wasn't quite sure with your question if you meant access to get down to a waterway or just access along the waterway and the banks. I think that.
Well, I guess I would say both.
So in that respect, I think what Brendan had said was true. We don't really address access down to a waterway, whatever public access there is now. We don't change any of that. What this bill does do is clarifies, and we've based this on what the common law, as we understand it from the Attorney General's opinion, on what the public can do on the waterway and also on the beds and banks of the waterway. And then when Brendan mentioned what the public can do above the ordinary high water line as opposed to below, I would say that is probably where we are not exactly consistent with where the rights that the Attorney General's office says that the public has with respect to what they can do above the ordinary high water line. We have ours restricted to medical emergency, portage, or something. There's some damage to the boat where you need to get the boat and yourself out of the water. And I don't want to speak for the Attorney General's office, but just in what I've heard them say and what their opinion says is that the Attorney General believes that under the common law, access is something more than that, but not. It would have to be necessary. It's somewhere between necessary and the emergency and portage that we use, but where that is and what that is, we're not certain.
And just if I can add on to the tail end of that, Senator Shields, I think that I would look at that situation as being overlaid on top. So this is a codification of part of that, and it's clear that that would be allowed. But if there was something else allowed greater than that for access, if the Attorney General's opinion is correct, from common law, then this bill would not address that, but it certainly wouldn't prohibit it.
Any more questions?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm just, you know, I've been beat up on both sides of this issue for a long time, and just the sense of fairness in me just is, it's a real generalized thing, but if you are fair, the question becomes, have the public's rights to access to streams been enhanced or diminished overall by the effects of the bill? And that was the question I was trying to get to. And
I think the answer to that question is depends upon your perspective, Senator Shields. I mean, I think it's a subjective, the question calls for a subjective response. Legally?
Well, I don't know.
Whoever wants to respond. Neither one of you may want to respond to the question.
I'll go first. I just want to just Senator Brown, Senator Shields, I think your use of access in that phrase is important, and I think my first answer, I was interpreting your use of access to be river access, as in from the uplands to the river itself. And I think if you use that in a more broad term, as far as river access generally, as in can we access rivers for recreational use, this bill would generally codify what is understood to be the public use doctrine, in that sense, would hopefully add clarity to access of rivers.
Senator Ringo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to clarify the meaning of the phrase at any time as it's used on page 2, line 6 of the bill, in defining floatable.
Mr. McCarthy, why don't you respond to that, and then Ms. Deckert, maybe you can go to intent.
Well, let me ask a specific question.
Okay.
Does at any time mean, let's say you have a river that is bone dry 11 months of the year, but 12 months it is floatable as defined, or for 1 month it's floatable as defined in subsection 8 there. Is it floatable then? Because you have 1 month out of the year when you've got water in it, does that make it potable?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, as long as that is not an ephemeral waterway, I would say yes, it does make it floatable for those periods of time that a boat can actually float down it.
Oh, and how do we define ephemeral?
Ephemeral is defined starting on the previous page and running into the top of the second page as flowing only during and immediately after periods of heavy precipitation.
I see. Okay. Well, I just want to clarify. So, as long as it's not ephemeral, the fact that a river may at times not allow a boat to float down it, you would still call it floatable.
Senator Brown, Senator Ringo, I believe that that is the proper interpretation of case law on this subject matter, that there were streams that have been subject of cases, mostly log drive cases, as you know, in which they were using spring flows to determine whether a stream was usable or not in as a highway of commerce. And spring flows would be typically higher than summer flows. So I think that phrase, that this definition of floatable comes directly from the case law, and that at any time is from, you know, directly from words used by the court.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
On page 2, it describes the land board shall adopt and administer a management plan, and that the management plan may, and then it uses the phrase, modify the time, manner, height, and extent of recreational uses. Could the land board reduce the public access to a degree that would not occur if the river were otherwise found to have been navigable?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I'll answer this since it's a land board related question. On rivers that have been deemed navigable, and I'll use the Sandy River as an example, because that's a river that the land board actually declared navigable, and it went through the study process that we have in statute now. On rivers like that, that the state has asserted title to and are state owned, the land board has the authority to restrict use on those rivers when it deems appropriate. And I know it has done so on several rivers, the Sandy being one of them, in areas that we've learned that there were folks camping to the point of living there. There were some problems related to human waste issues, and also I think open fires was a problem, and so were some drug and alcohol related issues. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Ringo,
just follow up. Would the type of restrictions that are contemplated under Section 2, could those exceed restrictions that would otherwise be allowed under a finding of navigability? In other words, could these restrictions go further in modifying the time, manner, type, and extent of recreational uses?
All right, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't know what the restrictions on the land board are with respect to a navigable river. I don't know. I guess that would be a question for the land board's attorney. I know that it has restricted use in some ways. I don't know if it could just all out say, you know what, no more public use on the Sandy River at any time, you know, within the next 5 years. I'm not sure if they could go that far. I don't know where their authority ends now, so I can't really answer that.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I sort of hate to conjecture, but
like, don't.
Well, I want your best
best opinion is that, you know, if these states were deemed navigable because of the condition of the river, then they would fall into state ownership, and I believe the state could condition its ownership in any other way it conditions any other lands that it owns. with the exception of the fact that there would be, for certain things, a navigational servitude, which would certainly allow use of the river, the water, you know, the surface of the water. But I think as far as generally conditioning other uses, perhaps, of the banks, I think that probably fall under the general state ownership. But that is sitting here at the table not far from a guess.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up.
Senator Ringo?
I am just trying to understand whether this opens the door for restricting public access in a way that won't occur under our current system of navigability. That's what I'm trying to understand. Is there a possibility that this bill might allow restrictions of public access in a way that couldn't occur under our current system?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I can't answer that definitively. I know the intention going into this bill is not to place restrictions on public use unless there's an absolute need to do so. And what Brendan mentioned with the navigable servitude, that does ring a bell. I think there is a federal navigable servitude that somewhat restricts the land board's ability to place restrictions on public use on these waterways. But beyond that, I think their authority is probably pretty broad right now. All right.
Any other questions for this group of folks? There's a gentleman in the audience by the name of Ernie. Are you wishing to testify?
Yeah, for 10 years,
sir, have you testified before on the bill?
No.
Okay, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes. Why don't you come on up, please?
Okay.
Okay, all right. Are you going to support this going to budget anyway? Okay. Okay, all right.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. What I've done, I've managed a boat dock. I did it on our own at Clackamas River.
Need to have you state your name for the record.
Oh, Ernie Coons.
Okay.
And it got pretty hairy. I mean, I've had to carry guns and everything down there. And what I'm concerned of is hope they don't start going through our land. I own a lot of property along the river, but I don't stop people to fish, and I don't go on their property to fish. I mean, to hunt and trespass and whatever. What I'm really concerned of is if you give them too much law, which you have the law, they got right to fish anyway, they're going to start doing a lot of stuff. I've had fence torn down. I have fence stolen. I have wood stolen from me, and it's unreal. So finally, in 10, 12 years, we got the place cleaned up. I stopped 2 forest fires. One, I did it on my own. One, I had to get the fire department. It would burn all my woods down. And I've had 4 girls camp overnight. They asked me to use my facilities. I don't mind it. I let them use the facilities.
And what river did you say you were on?
On the Clackamas River.
Okay.
1 mile below McIver Park.
Okay.
And I do a lot of rafting on that river. And I raft that river for years. I take people down it. I teach them how to swim the river. I know how to swim treacherous rivers. I know how to do all that stuff. I don't like to see me having to pay for a license to have a rubber raft to go down in to go rafting. I think that's not right. And if you really want to be concerned about the river, check out the river where the loggers, the Crown Zellerbach and Publisher fertilize in the woods up there. They're using 400 pounds to an acre. Then they're spraying deadly poison up it. It's getting into the Clackamas River.
I need you to move a little closer to the mic, sir.
I go talk to the government people who test the water. Where I'm at, it's not even supposed to be 1 point per million. It's 8 point per million. It's leaving a rubbery scum, and they're worried about a larva to get in the river. So, theoretically, if it wasn't for me and my daughter got ran over twice, for if we didn't, like, I feared the people drink and drug, and I caught this one lady, 11 o'clock in the night, and her husband, on a big boat. They had a fire going. It was just here before the big heavy rains come. And man, oh man, oh man, I didn't think I was going to get out of there alive. I mean, that lady, I've never heard women swear so much in my life.
You haven't been to the Oregon legislature then?
I've been dealing with Jan House, and we're having a hard time with her, therefore the scenic waterway and stuff. And the people across the river, they're supposed to be planting trees. They're spraying all along the bank. They're dumping their garbage in on the side, so when the river goes high, it goes down the river. And they know all about it. And I live 9 miles from Carter.
So, sir, who's your legislator? Do you know who your state senator is? I'm guessing Senator Metzger.
Yeah, well, Schrader used to be in one of them, and there's an attorney. I can't think of his name off the top.
Okay. Well, we'll try and find out whoever represents that area and let him know some of the issues that you're facing.
Rick Messinger.
Rick Metzger, that's what I think.
Yeah,
that's what I think, too. We'll talk to Senator Metzger and tell him some of the issues that you're facing and see if he can help you.
You know, I don't mind people. I caught a young couple out there. I didn't even have hardly any clothes. And they're up there sleeping all night with a shirt on. I don't know how they keep warm. They must be laying on top of each other to keep warm because
well,
I'd be...
Spiced up.
Did I say something?
No.
No, I didn't. Anyway, I never stopped to anybody. And where I'm at, it's no good fishing anyway. But they do come through, and I just let the guys know, and then they say, fine, and they find it out anyway. But I'm concerned just rafting, because I do a lot of rafting. And my wife and I have taken many, many, many people, and I train them how to swim the river. And I saved 3 people from drowning in my life.
That's great. Good.
So... Well, that's my concern, and I don't want to see money go to that marine stuff in Portland, because them guys, they'll take the money and they'll spend it useless. Feldheimer Road was supposed to be built better than that. It took me 10 years to get them to build that road. What did they build it? They didn't build it right. They didn't widen the corners. Fishermen and their boats come down. I my toes and fingers, I don't have enough of them to count how many close calls of wrecks we put in their hat. And people live down there, they understand to stay over, but it's too narrow of a road. They just fly down there, and what can you do?
Well, thank you. We really appreciate you coming and expressing your concerns. If you'd leave your name and address, we'll attempt to pass your concerns on to the Marine Board as well as to Senator Metzger to see if he can help address some of the issues.
Yeah, I get some of the stuff solved down there because it's getting to be a nightmare.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Also, I just wanted to mention for the record, committee staff had conversations with Brad Swank. Currently, there is a better and less expensive way to do the fine collection through the special account. There's already a centralized system for all other fines. We can certainly do this in this bill. I think that's an appropriate conversation for ways and means. Senator Farrelly, we are in work session.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move the Dash 5 amendments.
Senator Farrelly moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1028. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to just make a brief statement and then move the bill as amended to the Budget Committee. If that is the appropriate
motion. That is the appropriate motion.
There's been just an awful lot of conversation about Senate Bill 1028 that's been characterized by people who have great interest in this issue, recreationists and landowners. I just want to make clear that it's my opinion, after having studied this issue and worked on this issue 8 years now, that in light of the, my opinion that the navigability process is just not very productive. It takes a long time. It's a very expensive process. It can be a very emotional process. People feel a serious sense of loss when either the rivers are declared navigable or a sense of gain when the rivers are declared navigable, depending on whether or not they're recreationists or landowners. But it is an end game. Somebody wins, somebody loses. In studying the issue of river recreation, it's become very clear to me that management is probably the solution to the issue, rather than declarations of ownership or declarations of rights, either states' rights or individual rights or conferred rights or inferred rights or assumed rights. The bill that we have before us is an attempt to set forth some real clear definitions about what recreation opportunities are available and where. It is an attempt to do that in a way that doesn't declare ownership, doesn't touch on the issues of ownership. It does define in statute the rights of recreations to float. It incorporates the latest opinion from the Attorney General about the rights of recreations to float. It sets up a situation where both river recreations and river landowners have to use their best efforts to try to respect the rights of each other and the reasonable person rules invoked by this bill. The other thing it does is it creates a commission that's actually charged with the responsibility of identifying and trying to reduce conflicts. No other organization in the state has that charge. So for a variety of reasons, I absolutely believe that an approach like the one that's characterized in Senate Bill 1028 is the best approach to try to balance the equities and the issues between river recreationists and private landowners. My hope is that this will, in fact, lead to the prospect of eliminating a lot of the conflicts by making river recreationists identifiable to landowners, by clarifying the river recreation access up to the high water mark, by creating this commission that will deal with some of these management issues, and by helping to fund river recreation opportunities, law enforcement, sanitation, search and rescue, and other needful services that non-motorized recreationists need and that landowners will benefit from as well. There's a lot of gets for everybody in this process, and a lot of good things can happen here. I don't think that we'll ever convince the strict constitutionalists that they're not losing something here. And I don't think we'll ever be able to convince the landowners who believe in the inviolability of their land ownership that they're not losing something here. But I think the mass of Oregonians over time will recognize that what we're trying to do here is to set up a recreation opportunity, clarify the rights of all parties, and reduce conflict. That's what I think this bill does. So I'm happy to make the motion to move it down to the budget process, and I hope there we can clarify the issues of fees. I'm not very excited about a $2 per foot fee. I think that needs to be worked out somehow. I think there might be a better way to collect the dollars and administer the dollars, and I hope we can deal with that in the budget committee. I heard the discussion of people's concerns about whether or not this would impinge in some way or somehow reduce the opportunity for recreation that people have. I think that's probably one of those things that it will be in the eye of the beholder. I know Senator Ringo was concerned about the issue of whether or not the commission could create management plans that were more restrictive under just the simple declaration of navigability. I will just point out we have the river. The Sandy River has been declared navigable. There are some recreation restrictions on the Sandy River. The Lower Deschutes is a nationally recognized river. It has a national designation, but it also has a recreation management plan. I don't believe that's declared navigable. So the point is there's a variety of different flexible options out there. I don't think this eliminates anybody's opportunity. I think this will clarify what people's opportunities are. So I know that not all of the critics will ever be satisfied with this. I hope in time as we see the recreation management plan develop that comes out of the partnership between landowners and recreationists that will be on this commission, that some of the problems that we've had will get solved. Now, that's an awful lot, but it's taken me 8 years to get to the place where I hope we can do something positive in this regard. I think this is our best effort today.
Thank you, Senator Ferry. I really appreciate your leadership on this issue. Senator Shields.
As I said earlier today, I have some serious concerns about the bill. And I am, to be honest, tired of the pressure that I've gotten, the hours and hours of talk from both sides on the issue. But today, Madam Chairman, I'm just going to trust my majority leader and give you a courtesy vote to send it down to the Senate Budget Committee. And I look forward to a fees discussion down there.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Sir Atkinson, you wish to weigh in as well?
I certainly do.
Thank you.
And I do appreciate all the hard work of both Senator Farioli and Senator Brown, but I'm not quite as courteous, so I will be objecting to the motion today, and that's fine.
as someone who has spent their lifetime on the river, on various different rivers, someone who's been chased off of rivers at gunpoint a couple of more times than I'll admit, or probably not admit on the record. In fact, someone who has been yelled at within the last 10 months with a member who's in the audience from a crabby old man who thought he was a lawyer, probably watched too much People's Court. I do know that the standard here, if you're going to go river by river by river by river, no one's going to know what the law is. And I think you're begging for conflict. I think that the greatest leadership I've seen on this is actually Montana Governor Roscoe, who put this thing to bed when he passed what was called the Montana model. There was no fees. It was actually in conjunction with a little bill that I passed for Oregon on private property, no posting of private property, which we passed in 1999, which was also part of the Montana Sportsman's Act. But my real problem with this bill, as someone who owns boats and spends time out there, and I know I certainly don't mean to put myself in a different category, but a lot of people making the rules here I know don't own boats or spend a lot of time out there. I'm not paying a fee and putting stickers and identification on boats. I think it's highly inconsistent when this body, I remember Senator Ringo and I both spoke and on a memorial to Congress urging us not to pay fees for the Northwest Forest Pass to go out and use our public lands. I feel just in principle the same way I shouldn't have to pay a fee to go use a river. And I certainly don't want to put numbers and pay fees on my boat. Now, one of my boats, which I use the least, I have to pay for because it's got a motor on it. But the boats that I use the most, that's because it's got a motor, which I completely disagree with also. I think the fees on that are ridiculous. But my other boats, which cause absolutely no harm to the environment, are perfectly quiet and are beautiful works of art, shouldn't have some kind of government sticker on them. I just think that's ridiculous. Anybody who's on the river knows who's on the river. Everybody on my river knows who I am on my boat. And that's just how it is out in the real world. So I appreciate the hard work. I like the Montana plan, but all best.
Thank you. We were going to wait for Senator Ringo, but I think we're okay. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo? Senator Shields?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Ferriola?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Smoking.
All right. Anything further to come before the committee? All right. Thank you all very much.
Works of art.
Yep.